Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
A few months ago, I went to an estate sale at a house that looked pretty unremarkable from the outside. The inside was another story. Nobody had staged the things for sale in this house. It would have been impossible. There were just haphazard paths cleared through mounds of stuff, piles of clothes and old magazines and pretty rocks and marbles and broken doll parts and empty food containers and dozens of boxes of blank note cards. We saw kitchen stuff in the bedrooms and closets literally spilling forth their contents. No rhyme or reason to where anything was in the house, and very little room to move around. It appeared whoever had lived there had been unable to give or even throw anything away for years. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's hard for me to imagine anyone living in a house like that. But the International OCD Foundation estimates 2% of people have serious problems with hoarding, which could mean there is a hoarder on your own block or in your apartment building. Folks living in those conditions are often deeply unhappy, and all their possessions can pose safety hazards to them and their neighbors. The issue will be addressed Friday at the Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst, sponsored by Mental Health America of Greater Dallas. And we're joined today by keynote speaker Randy Frost. He's professor of psychology at Smith College and author of the book Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. Randy, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be here.
What is hoarding exactly?
Well, hoarding is a complex set of behaviors, and there appear to be three separate features. The first is an excessive level of acquisition. That is, things come into the house in a greater than normal way. The second is saving behavior. That is, decision to save something or difficulty getting rid of it. And those two things are probably the kinds of things, if we think about our culture compared to what it was a century ago, those are behaviors that probably characterize all of us, acquiring a lot of things and saving them. The third feature is the one that really seems to separate, or one of the things that separates people who have a problem with this from those who don't, and that's the ability to keep all these things organized. So these three features sort of go together to make this complex set of behaviors.
So if there's a place for everything and it doesn't cause a problem, that's not hoarding, or it's just hoarding and you happen to be rich enough to own a big enough house?
That's not hoarding if it does not cause a problem. That's one of the diagnostic criteria in DSM. DSM has just made hoarding a separate disorder in its new revision 2013. And the behaviors that are described have to do with acquisition and difficulty discarding. But the real turning point for when this becomes a disorder versus when it's not is whether it causes any impairment or dysfunction in the ability to live.
How do people with a hoarding disorder form a different relationship to their possessions than people without the problem? In other words, why is it that you and I can throw things away once we don't need them, and folks who are suffering from a hoarding disorder can't?
Well, here's the interesting thing. This is a fascinating topic to look at, because what we see in people with hoarding disorder is the same kinds of attachments that all of us form to our possessions. Our possessions have a magical quality for all of us. So, for instance, that ticket stub from a favorite concert, there's nothing about the physical characteristics of that ticket stub that give it any special meaning. It's no different than any other ticket stub. What gives it meaning is the association one has between that ticket stub and the event. And that association is in the person's head, not in the ticket stub. Now, psychologists call this phenomenon an essence. So this object has an essence, a meaning that goes beyond its physical characteristics. But what happens in hoarding is that that essentialism, that essence, becomes exaggerated. So now this object, any object that is owned, and it seems to generalize to virtually any possession, that gets an exaggerated sense of meaning. So a good example of this is once I was working with someone who had this problem, and we were going through papers, and she picked up an ATM envelope that was the envelope you get from a bank with money in it sometimes. It was empty. It was 5 years old, and on the back she'd written what she spent the money on. It wasn't anything unusual, grocery store items, drugstore items, a few things like that. She put the envelope in our recycle box, and she started to cry. And what she said was, it feels like I'm losing that day in my life. And if I lose too much, there'll be nothing left of me. So her feeling was that that object sort of unlocked the memories for that day, and that was a piece of her personal history that was now going to be gone. So you can see with that kind of fear, she resisted letting go of it.
I read that some people who have a problem with hoarding hang on to things in case they might need them. You know, most of us have an empty mayonnaise jar, you know, in the cabinet somewhere in case we need it, but we don't have 30.
Right, right. And that seems to be a second feature of this attachment, and that is sort of an imagined usefulness. And it's almost as though if you can imagine a use for something, you have to hang on to it until it can be used in that way. So the same woman I was talking about a moment ago, she saved hundreds of cardboard tubes from the inside of toilet paper rolls. And what she said was, I'm saving these for my son's art teacher because they make great art projects. Well, she didn't even know her son's art teacher and had no idea whether or not he wanted these things. But the idea that this could be a use for this possession was enough to make her feel guilty if she wasted it. And there's a key difference here between sort of an exaggerated essentialism, where what you feel if you get rid of something is a sense of grief. Hmm. Here, if she got rid of those toilet paper rolls, what she would experience was guilt.
So you have the combination, I guess, of an elevated sense of excitement if you acquire something that you might be able to use, and elevated guilt or grief over getting rid of something that might be useful.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. So it makes it difficult to get rid of anything because of the way you feel afterwards.
Tell us about folks who are hanging on to information.
Well, it's sort of the same. It's the imagined use for information. Partly it's as though this information, this keeping a stack of newspapers and magazines that far outstrips the amount of time you have to read them, it's almost as though they have the sense that they know what's in those piles without having read it. And that potential knowledge is theirs to have as long as they hang on to that possession. But if they get rid of the possession, they've lost that potential. They've lost that opportunity.
It would seem like the logic of, say, owning a computer would make it easier for an information hoarder to get rid of those old papers and magazines. But we're dealing with people who are not seeing the world through a fully rational lens.
Well, we've tried on occasion to use computers and pictures to try to get people to loosen their attachment to objects, but it really doesn't seem to work very well. There's something about the tangible object that is important. And one of the things that we think is part of it is a different way of processing information. So information is processed visually and sometimes spatially. And so unless I see something, I won't be able to process it. For instance, one of our clients, a woman whose bedroom was completely cluttered. She had clothes from the top of her dresser all the way to the ceiling, but her dresser drawers were empty. Hmm. And what she said was, if I put the clothes in the drawer, I won't be able to see them, and then they'll be lost to me. So the way in which she's processing information is relying on these visual cues for memory.
Is there a relationship between hoarding and ADHD?
Yes. We find about a third of people with hoarding disorder meet diagnostic criteria for ADHD, and many more have symptoms of ADHD, which makes it difficult for them to work on the problem. So if your house is full and you're looking at this problem of trying to get rid of all these things, it's very difficult to go through that effortful process because of the distractibility and impulsivity associated with ADHD.
Tell us about the difference between hoarding and collecting, because there may be a lot of spouses out there that think, well, you're just hoarding baseball cards or China dolls or whatever.
Yeah, what we typically see in hoarding disorder is the saving of a wide variety of things, almost anything that comes into the person's possession is something that is saved. In collecting, the saving behavior is much more focused. Typically, it's focused on one theme or a small number of themes. Secondly, these objects in collecting, these objects that are saved, typically are organized in some fashion. There's some rationale for why some things are acquired and other things aren't. And we typically don't see that in hoarding disorder. And the third major difference is that people who collect things love to show them off. They like to show other people what these things are. It's almost as though this is a manifestation of who I am, and it's something that gives me pleasure. In hoarding, we tend not to see that. People with hoarding disorder don't let anyone else see their stuff. They don't let anyone else touch their stuff, and they're reluctant to share it in any way.
Do hoarders look pretty much like their peers when they're out on the street? Are they any more likely to be, say, disheveled in appearance?
Yeah, typically, there certainly are some people with hoarding disorder who are disheveled, but for the most part, they look just like everyone else.
Hmm. Randy, when you first started this research more than 20 years ago, your assumption was, I think like many people's today, was that hoarding in many cases might be an outgrowth of a period of deprivation in one's life. Tell us what you learned about that.
Well, that was one of our first hypotheses when we started studying this. And we asked people about their experience of early material deprivation, and we found no evidence that was related to the development of hoarding problems. And now that finding has since been replicated by others. So it's a convenient explanation, and it certainly fits with some people's experience where they feel like they need this so that they won't be deprived. But it really is not, it doesn't explain much about hoarding behavior and how it develops.
So if you've had early deprivation, you might turn into a hoarder, but you're no more or less likely to do so.
That's right.
Okay. Tell us about how hoarding changes over the course of a lifetime. When does it first show up?
Well, interestingly, it shows up very early in life. For the most part, people with hoarding disorders start this behavior sometime between 10 and 20 years old. Mm. It's pretty mild at that point. It's limited to more saving behavior and acquiring behavior, and it doesn't get severe until several decades later.
Do we know why it gets worse? So many other mental conditions toward the end of life tend to improve.
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't really know why the severity of this increases, and it certainly it often increases to the point where it reaches a maximum level of severity, like the house you were talking about at the beginning, and then it sort of stays there for the rest of the person's life.
What are the psychosocial consequences for someone who lives with a hoarder?
Family members who live with people with hoarding disorder have a variety of problems associated with it. If they grew up in a home that was cluttered at a hoarding level, before the age of 10, those consequences seem more severe. They tend to develop higher levels of social anxiety. They tend to have a fractured relationship with their parents that lasts for the rest of their life. And they have these funny kinds of reactions, sort of anxiety or panic reactions for things like the doorbell. Hmm. And that goes back to what happens early in life, living in a hoarded home. When the doorbell rings unexpectedly, there's panic because no one wants to open the door and let anyone see inside.
We're speaking this hour with Randy Frost. He's professor of psychology at Smith College, and he wrote a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. He'll be the keynote speaker Friday at the MHA Dallas Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Randy Frost. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College. A few years ago, he wrote a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. He'll be in town Friday at the MHA Dallas Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Randy, let's talk about what might help a hoarder. It doesn't necessarily help just to come in and clean everything out for them. They need treatment.
That's right. It used to be the case when this was really first identified and really not well understood, is that when someone's home was deemed to be unsafe, people would come in, health departments, elder service agencies, and clean it out. But what happened was that changed the condition of the property temporarily, but it didn't do anything about the person's behavior. So in short order, it filled up again. There was a town near here who spent the entire health department budget clearing out one house of someone with a hoarding problem. And 18 months later, they were back again, and the house was full. And not only that, but now the relationship between the individual who lives there and anyone trying to help is strained.
So what does work?
Well, we've developed a treatment that works reasonably well. It's certainly not perfect, and we have a lot more to go in terms of understanding how to go about helping people. But we focus on these three different things in treatment. First, the acquisition piece. There are a couple of things that seem to help. Now, the first thing that happens with people who have this problem and have excessive levels of acquiring is that when they are looking at something that they're about to acquire, they want to buy or to pick up, what happens is their attention gets so narrowly focused on this object that they forget about the context of their life. It's a little bit like the experience of being hooked on a computer game. If you've ever been hooked on a computer game, you're playing the game and you forget where you are, or you even forget who you are. None of that information is accessible because of your focus of attention. So one of the first things we do with people is we sit them down and ask them, when they're not in an acquiring episode, we ask them to create a list of questions that they think they ought to answer before they acquire something. And for the most part, they come up with the questions that we all would come up with. Do I need it? Do I have enough money for it? Do I have enough space for it? Do I already have some of these? And then we have them carry that list of questions with them wherever they go. And if they want to acquire something, they pull out the list and answer the questions. And it brings the context of their life back into the decision about whether to pick this thing up or not. So the other thing we do with acquiring is we treat it a little bit like a physical conditioning paradigm. Because when you think about it, what's happening here is that people have an urge to acquire something, and they cannot tolerate that urge. What most people tell us is the feeling is this: if I don't buy this, I'm going to regret it, I'm not going to be able to stop thinking about it, and I'm going to do whatever I can to come back and get it. So this feeling of overwhelming urge is what seems to be driving this behavior. So what we do is we arrange a hierarchy of situations where the urge is weak all the way to strong. And then we have them start with the weakest urge and then engage in that behavior. We start out with what we call drive-by non-shopping, where we have them drive by a store that's difficult for them to resist. And then we have them drive by slowly. Then we have them walk by the store. Then we have them go in the store and pick something up, put it down, and walk out, and so forth. So we're basically training them to tolerate the urge to acquire without doing so.
That's so interesting, because it's not very different from what somebody might do for a patient who had a fear of spiders.
Exactly, exactly. But here, it's not a habituation issue. In fear of spiders, you're wanting to habituate the anxiety. You're wanting to get the anxiety level down. Here, it's really that urge. And here's the thing that makes hoarding different from other anxiety disorders, is that in the acquiring episodes, people experience intense pleasure. It's a high. And for some people with this problem, that's the only thing they get pleasure out of. So in addition to these things, we have to sort of reorient their lifestyle to find other pleasurable activities that can take the place of acquiring.
You mentioned that anxiety that family members might feel when the doorbell rings. What about hoarders themselves? How often do they realize that they have a problem? Do they feel a sense of shame based on the condition of their homes? Or do they think that everything that they've done until they receive treatment is pretty justifiable?
It varies. There are a few people with hoarding disorder who appear to have limited insight. That is, they don't recognize this is really problematic. But the vast majority of them seem to. And you can kind of see this level of insight coming out in different ways. Even someone who says they're completely justified in this behavior still experiences a sense of shame and humiliation if anyone were to open the door and look in their house. That reflects something about insight, something about, okay, this is not quite normal. This is not quite the way other people live. So insights in hoarding is kind of a tough thing to determine because in part it depends on who they're talking to. So if someone comes to my door, a health officer, and tells me that he's concerned about the way I live and that I'm not living the right way, I'm going to be very defensive about it, and I'm probably going to argue back against him. That's the sort of experience you get. And the other thing, in families, we see family members who for decades have been criticizing their loved one with a hoarding problem. And so how does the loved one with hoarding problem deal with that? Well, oftentimes, because they can't change their behavior, they develop a different way of coping with that kind of argument, and that is to argue against it, to say it's not my problem, leave me alone.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have David on the line in Weatherford. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, thank you for the – it's interesting. There are some people that I know that it kind of makes me ask a question here. Originally, it was one question. It might be two questions, but it could also be combined as one, like a two-tailed question. So you have, compulsive hoarding. Now, what I'm curious about, what's the difference from that to, for example, just laziness, where, and again, maybe it's just a perception from someone that's not a hoarder, where you say, one of my neighbors used to have all this stuff just around his trailer house, and he didn't have trash service, and so if he was done using it, he'd just throw it out in the backyard. He'd go inside, and there's all this stuff around. But it wasn't like it was stuff that he was personally attached to. It was just, there's just stuff.
What do you think about that, Randy?
Well, it is one of the myths about hoarding that these folks are lazy or messy. And in fact, it's not quite true. It's not laziness that prevents them from getting rid of things, but the attachments they have to it and the fear of waste if they throw something away. For instance, one of our folks who we treated early on, she spent 3 hours every day working on the papers in her living room, and you could not tell a difference at the end of those 3 hours in terms of the stuff and how much of it she was able to get rid of. But yet she worked hard for those 3 hours. So it wasn't laziness on her part. It was an inability to get rid of things.
Why would hoarding be more common among men than women?
Well, in fact, it's not. It appears as though hoarding is equally distributed between men and women. Early on, there were a couple reports suggesting that it was more common in men than women. But the more epidemiological studies that have come out, it appears as though it's relatively equal. Now, what we see is women show up more often for treatment, and women also volunteer more often to be in studies about hoarding.
Hmm. I have not met anyone, I don't believe, that matches this description, but I've known people who said, say, both their grandparents were hoarders. Does that happen often, or is it that one person learns to tolerate living with another person who really has a problem?
Most often, when there's a couple and a hoarding situation, there is one person who is tolerating the other person's behavior. They're sort of colluding with them, in a sense. Looking the other way and accommodating the behavior, because if they don't, what's likely to happen is that that couple will split up. Hmm. We see a much higher incidence of separation and divorce in people with hoarding problems, and you can see why. If the person's unable to control this behavior, and it impinges on the life of the other person. Typically, we see this pattern build where once the home starts to fill up, there are increasing arguments about the clutter and the hoarding behavior, and finally some kind of altercation where the partner throws things out clandestinely and the other person gets angry, and then the situation escalates, or the person's given an ultimatum that either clean up or I'm leaving. The person can't do it without help, and so many of these families split up. And the sad thing about it is that once the person goes from living with someone to living alone, the problem seems to get worse.
Is it a risk for homelessness?
It is a risk for homelessness. There are a couple of studies now looking at the probability of homelessness given a hoarding situation. It does elevate the likelihood of people becoming homeless. And we see, interestingly enough, a higher proportion of hoarding behavior among homeless populations than we do people who aren't homeless.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Jeremy in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
My mom has a hard time throwing away food, even though it's about to expire. Does hoarding food have anything to do with poverty?
Not that we know of. It looks, from what we know about hoarding things like food, it's related to this phenomena of sort of scrupulosity, the fear of wasting things. And the idea gets in the person's head that somehow this would be wasteful to throw this away. And a whole host of other things might go on in the person's mind thinking about how this is wasteful, how other people might appreciate this more than I would, and so forth and so on. And that kind of fear of waste seems to be what's underlying saving things like food.
Okay, so many of the things, Randy, that you have described, I think everybody listening who is mentally well and healthy today can relate to, right? The, I should hang on to this because I might need it, the enjoying acquiring something. You know, most of these people will not develop into hoarders. I wonder if there is any advantage to trying to identify people who might someday have a problem and getting them into treatment early, and if that's even possible before, acquiring and failure to purge one's unnecessary possessions has become a problem.
Right. Yeah, it would be great if we could identify people early, or at least in the early stages of hoarding, so we knew what to do. The problem is that there are no good markers at this point. Kids often will save things that don't make sense to adults. So my kids, for instance, used to save the boxes that presents came in, and they seemed to be more interested in the box than the present. And that sort of thing looks like maybe someday it might develop an hoarding, but for the most part, it doesn't. In fact, what it looks like is there might be some kind of developmental process where what happens is that as a child, we get sort of interested in the almost aesthetic qualities of objects, the shape, the color, the textures, and so forth. But as we get older, to live more efficiently, to learn how to live effectively, we kind of let those kinds of appreciations for the physical world drift away. And a good example, but people with hoarding problems don't seem to do that. A good example is Irene, one of the people in our book, Stuff. When I went to her house one day, her eyes lit up and she said, "I've got to show you something." She ran into the next room and she came back with this large clear plastic bag filled with bottle caps. And she said, "Look at these bottle caps. Aren't they beautiful? Look at the shape and the color and the texture." And it's clear that from my perspective, when I see a bottle cap without a bottle associated with it, the only thought I have is that it's trash. But for her, there are a whole host of associations that she has about the aesthetic qualities of this bottle cap. So for her, making a decision about how to get rid of it requires a lot more complex thinking than it does for me. And this is a pattern that we see in people with hoarding problems, this kind of complexity of thought and the nature of the associations they have. In fact, there's some evidence now that people with hoarding disorders may have a higher level of intelligence than the rest of us. And that's why one of the people in our book described it as a tree with too many branches. There's just so much information they're processing about these objects that they get confused, and it gets too complex for them to work their way through it and make a decision about getting rid of them.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Dill on the line. Hi, Dill.
Hi. I have a case study for you. I had a friend who died last year. I've known since the sixth grade. I'm 73, so it's over 60 years. He collected so much stuff when they entered his home, they couldn't get into it. When I would talk with him, he'd say that he'd need something like a weed whacker, and he had three or four of them somewhere, but he'd go out and buy another one because he couldn't find it. And I did I was perhaps his only friend. He was betrayed by family and women throughout his life, and he had this great suspicion against people and institutions. And at first, I studied him, and I couldn't help him. I really tried. And he ended up dying of health problems. But it wasn't a case where he was attached to this stuff emotionally. He had a Spock-like, unemotional nature. He was very intelligent, you mentioned this earlier, that some people are like that. And he did have a fear of wasting things. He was brought up with very conservative Midwest values. But I developed another theory, and that is it seemed like he surrounded himself with all this stuff that he wasn't attached to, as a sense of security, almost a barrier against the world. And it was cruel to him, and this is the one thing that he could trust and count on. What is your thoughts on that?
Well, Dill, thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a quick break here, and we will let Randy comment in just a moment. We're speaking this hour with Randy Frost, who's professor of psychology at Smith College, author of the book Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. He'll be the keynote speaker Friday at the MHA Dallas Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Smith College psychology professor Randy Frost, author of Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. He'll be keynote speaker Friday at the MHA Dallas Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst. Before the break, Randy, we heard from Dill, who recalled his friend who seemed to use the items that he hung on to as a kind of barrier against the world.
Yes, exactly. And it's one of the things we frequently see and when people have a problem with hoarding is that they use these objects as sources of comfort and safety. Now, the interesting thing is that one of the things we've discovered in our research is that about half of people with hoarding disorder have some kind of trauma background or excessive level of stressful life events. But at the same time, they don't have an elevated comorbidity with post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you think if people have an elevated levels of trauma, they should have an elevated frequency of post-traumatic stress disorder, but we don't see that. So one of our hypotheses, and again, we don't have any data for it, but is that maybe these possessions form a buffer for people against the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. We've seen in a couple of cases a relationship between the two. One of our cases in our treatment outcome study was a woman who had been sexually assaulted several years earlier in her home. Now, she had a hoarding problem to begin with, But after the sexual assault, things got worse. And when we treated her for the hoarding symptoms, when she came in for treatment, there was no evidence of PTSD. But as she got better with the hoarding, as her home cleared out, as we approached the room in terms of clearing where the sexual assault happened, that's when the PTSD symptoms started to show up.
Wow.
So in some ways, it might be that this feeling of comfort is that, that possessions provide may help to buffer the development of other kinds of psychopathology.
All right. Let's talk on the phone now with Raylene in Fort Worth. Hi, Raylene.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you very much for your discussion. And I grew up in a household where both my father and my mother had hoarding issues. And as the oldest of three siblings, I was able to watch it progress over the years and see it get worse and worse. And I have, as I've gone into adulthood, I've actually been so aware of it that I've actually gone on the opposite end, and I have to fight OCD tendencies on a daily basis and have to control myself with going the opposite end of the spectrum. But my question for you is, for my brother and my sister, who are a few years younger than I am, as I watched them grow into adulthood, they did not break the cycle. And I see them both falling into this exact same cycle of hoarding all different kinds of things. Is there a way to intervene with a family member or a friend when you first start seeing these signs? Is there a way to get them to see it and a way to intervene?
There are a couple of things embedded in your question, Raylene, and I want to speak first to the family dynamic here. We do know now, there are a number of studies that seem to indicate that hoarding is at least in part genetic. Now, what is genetically transmitted is not so clear. It may not be the attachments to possessions, but more the information processing deficits that we see in hoarding. We haven't talked too much about those, but there are some information processing deficits that we think are the key to how it's genetically transmitted, so that family members, that is children of people with hoarding problems, are more likely to develop hoarding problems than other people are. So that's the first part. The second part has to do with how you can intervene early. One of the things that appears to happen when people develop a hoarding problem is that the attachments to these possessions form when they're acquired, when they come into the home, but once they land in the home, then there's very little interaction between the individual and the object. Hmm. Now, in part, this is because the homes fill up and there's so much they simply can't. And one of the things we've been finding lately is that if we just get people to engage with the objects in their home, and by engage, what I mean is start to tell the story of the object, then they seem to be a little less rigid in their attachment to the object. They're a little more likely to let that object go. So I would suggest that one of the things you can do is to sit down with them and have them describe to you what an object is, what part of a collection it belongs to, how it compares to other objects that they have that are like it, where do they get it, what does it mean to them, and so forth, and see whether their feelings about needing to save that object change at all. One of the things we do in treatment is, I described earlier how we dealt with acquisition, but how we deal with this difficulty discarding, is we try to get people to take a look at their beliefs about the importance of the possession and the meaning of the possession. And when we do that carefully, it's easier for people to detach from the object and let it go. And we think what happens over time is people avoid doing that altogether. So stuff builds up in their house and they don't think about it anymore. They just sort of throw it all in there and go on with their life as best they can.
Has hoarding probably existed throughout human history, or is this a phenomenon of modern consumer society?
It seems to be something that's gone on throughout history. You see references to it in literature, in the works of Charles Dickens, in the works of Russian novelist Gogol in his book Dead Souls, which was written in the mid-1800s. You see a character named Plushkin, who's sort of a classic description of a hoarding case. In fact, Plushkin, in Russian psychiatry, that's the name of hoarding disorder, Plushkin syndrome. We see references all the way back to Dante's Inferno has a reference to hoarding. One of the circles of hell is reserved for hoarders and wasters.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Denise on the line in Dallas. Hi, Denise.
Hi there. Well, I have got, to me it's unique. I don't know if it's probably everybody, but I am a long line of only children. And with that, I became the possessor of all the stuff. Now, my mother recently died, so I am got more stuff on me. And I really don't know what to do with everything. I mean, it cripples me. I hate it. So I don't know what to do. Is there help in Dallas for someone like me that just has too much and doesn't know what to do?
I think one of the things I would do to start with is contact the City of Dallas Senior Services Program. There is a hoarding task force in Dallas, and they will have information about helpers. You could come to the annual conference on Friday to learn more about it, and they will have information there, I'm sure, on people who can help you there.
Have you seen the television programs about people dealing with hoarding disorders?
Yes, I have.
Do you feel like they are educational? Do you feel like they're exploitative?
You know, my feeling on this is they're a little bit both. And it's sort of tipped now to the latter. In terms of when these programs started, I think one of the benefits of the program was that it showed that this was really a mental health problem. This is not a problem of laziness or messiness. There's something wrong with people's ability to manage their stuff, and they really have no control over it. So that part of it really showed that this is something serious, and it's not something comical. On the other hand, these shows tend to stigmatize people. They tend to show people in sort of the emotional throes of things. And they also give you the impression that the best way is to bring in a cleaning crew and sort of push the person and force them to throw stuff out, which is inaccurate. So I think now it's tipped more in that direction. So now it is a little bit exploitative.
All right, let's go on the phones now to Eric in Dallas. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. You're really doing a great job of exploring the psychological aspects and the academic aspects, I guess, of hoarding. I've got an aunt who drives my cousins crazy, and I was wondering if you could just take a moment to talk about some of the safety aspects of a home that is so cluttered up that it's impossible to keep clean. It's a fire hazard when you've got papers piled up everywhere. It's more likely that you'll have infestations of insects and rodents because there's a lot of nesting material there, and so on and so forth.
That's right. In fact, there are some serious hazard and safety issues related to hoarding. And first of all, related to safety, there is a fire risk here. And the risk is more than just a fire more likely to be started because there's a fuel source close to a heat source, but also what happens once a fire starts. So there was a study done in Australia, the state of Victoria, looked at their residential house fire records from a period of 10 years. And what they found that only 0.25% of all those residential house fires involved hoarding, but the hoarding fires involved 24% of fire-related deaths in residential house fires. So it's pretty serious concern. From a standpoint of what we do about it, if someone doesn't engage in treatment, and in fact, in the early stages of treatment, people take a harm reduction approach. So the idea here is, okay, before we start working on the behavior, let's reduce the level of harm in the home. And how do we do that? First of all, survey the home to make sure there are no heat sources and fuel sources close together. So you don't want piles of paper beside the stove in the kitchen, and so forth. Secondly, you want to make sure that means of egress are available. So the doors can't be blocked. The windows where you need to get out if you can't get to a door need to be unblocked. Third, there has to be pathways in the home so emergency personnel can get in to with a gurney in case they need to if there's a medical emergency. Fourth has to do with sanitary issues and level of squalor and so forth. So there's a progression, really, in a serious case like that where you start with, okay, well, how are we going to make the home safe? And then we move to how can we change the person's behavior to prevent this from happening again.
Is this a disorder that responds to medication?
It's not yet clear. There are only two studies that look specifically at hoarding and medication, and they are promising studies, but they're not control trials. So these are pilot studies where a small group was compared before and after taking the medication. So it's not yet clear whether medication will help for this problem.
Do you ever, given your level of expertise, do you ever see people, you know, out in the store and wonder if this individual has a problem or that one does?
You can sometimes tell. The easiest way to tell is if you see someone getting out of their car. Because one of the phenomena, one of the things we see in hoarding is that whatever container the person has available fills up, including cars. So you can often tell someone with a hoarding problem if their car is full. You can't often tell by looking at someone's home. In about half the cases, if it's a private dwelling, you see stuff collecting outside the home. But the other half, you really can't tell unless you look closely at the windows, and they tend to be dark. The blinds or shades are kind of wrinkled because there's stuff piled against them. That's the only way you can really tell by looking at a house.
Is there reason to believe this will get more common as our population ages?
It's quite possible, because what we see is a higher frequency of this behavior in people who are older. And partly that's because that's when it tends to get serious, so we see more of those cases. But when we do studies of this and ask for volunteers to be in our studies, the average age of those volunteers is their mid-50s. When we do similar studies of obsessive-compulsive disorder and ask for volunteers, their average age is in the 30s. So it does seem to be a disorder more characteristic of people who are older.
And as municipalities form task forces, it may be that we're taken, that the general public is taken by surprise at how common this is, but it sounds like cities are well aware.
I think now most cities are well aware of this problem. And before the mental health world got involved, it was clear to health departments and elder service agencies that this was a problem. But it took many years before the mental health people got an idea that this was a real problem. So now there are more than 100 hoarding task forces around the country and more every day. So it is a problem that there are a lot of people working on it now in contrast to, say, 20 years ago.
Randy Frost is professor of psychology at Smith College and author of the book Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. He'll give the keynote address Friday at the MHA Dallas Southwest Conference on Hoarding in Hearst. Randy, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myung, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is at KERAThink. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.